The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
According to Ben, when is hope not useful?
Ben is observant in the ways that he has seen things go on and suffer and continue in ruts. And, you know, people are hoping it will get better. But really, hope is kind of a useless emotion, I think, unless you're doing something to push yourself down that path.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Sheree Newman, talking with Colorado writer Laura Pritchett about her novel Stars Go Blue. Ben and his wife, Rennie, live on a cattle ranch in Colorado. So describe what's going on with them as the book opens.
When the book opens, Rennie has just noticed that Ben is leaving slips of paper all over. She's moved him back into the farmhouse. They were estranged, living on opposite ends of the ranch. They started that when their daughter was murdered by her ex-husband, or her abusive husband. And so they had moved apart, and then she realizes that something is amiss, and she brings him back to the farmhouse and starts caretaking. But she's a little bitter about this, and neither are sure they're in love and want each other in their lives, and so it's a bit complicated.
And so Ben gets a diagnosis of dementia. Also, Ray, the man who murdered their daughter, has just been released from prison.
That's right. Ben has gotten the diagnosis, and he's still in the stage of the disease where he knows he has a disease and that he needs to act fast if he wants to face down his fears about his own disease and face Ray, which he feels he really must do. He doesn't want to leave his family without confronting Ray and feeling that justice has been served or that Ray has changed or become a better man.
Because he only served 5 years for murdering their daughter.
Yeah, he got off early for good behavior. And that whole theme is important in the book of good behavior and kind of the unfairness of life. Ben has had good behavior his whole life, and yet he gets sentenced with the disease.
Yes. You wrote the novel in alternating chapters. Ben narrates a chapter, and then Rennie narrates a chapter. So let's hear from Ben first.
Sure. So this is Ben's point of view. The fields are poured ice, rippled and waved as if a frozen lake. Ben considers the way the sun has melted and the earth absorbed the snow that fell months ago, which is how such strange patterns got created. But he also entertains the idea that his pastures have reverted in time to the great sea they once were. Ben has been partial to water, always, which is why life gets measured in terms of irrigation and rainfall and acre feet and even the dry, rainless days needed for baling hay. Even now he considers the watersheds in his brain, how water moves through tissue, how rivers of electricity pulse in stops and starts. The pastures have never been this way, so icy, and it makes walking hard. There are no cattle to check, no fields to irrigate, nothing to doctor or wean or birth, and yet he wants to walk anyway, down the iced over dirt road to the back of the ranch, even though the walking is tough because this year the snow has not melted as it should. He has that memory thing. He can't remember the name, and he knows it's normal to be able to remember his childhood, but not yesterday, and not, on occasion, his wife's name, or the name of this daughter walking beside him. He's not supposed to feel bad about the things he can't remember, although he is allowed to feel bad about the fact that his disease only gets worse. Deeper still, he has clarified that he's allowed the terror and claustrophobia of wanting to say words that are dammed up inside. She comes more often now, this daughter. She says to walk her dog, a huge yellow puppy that is supposed to bring you things but does not. Just like his brain, this dog doesn't work right. The dog, whose name he can't remember, but it reminds him of music, is chasing those big birds out in the field. The dog sends them honking into the sky, and this reminds him of music, and he used to shoot those birds, and his wife would complain because cooking hamburger from one of their cows was always easier than cooking one of those big birds. He's never seen the likes of a winter like this. His daughter calls her yellow dog, and the creature comes galumphing or galloping or grazing towards them, but stops short to pick up a piece of frozen horse manure. "Damn it," his daughter says. "No, Satchmo, no." She pries the frozen square of manure from the dog's teeth and flings it away. Then she unzips her jacket and sighs, one of those frustrated sighs that is supposed to help get patience back, and which he hears from his wife all the time now. "Remember, Dad, how you used to say, 'Tell you what I'm gonna do, see?'" Sometimes his brain works if he can manage it like music, like a song, like a river that does not halt. So he sing-songs it. "Tell you what I'm gonna do, see?" With an accent like a Brooklyn boxer, although he has been a Colorado rancher all his life. He puts up his hands in the boxer pose, and that makes her laugh, and her laugh is like music. He wonders if she notices how all the wooden fence posts each have a small cap of frozen snow at the top. They put many of those posts in together, he with the post hole diggers and she with the tamp bar. He remembers how proud he was that she could and wanted to do such work. Some of the older posts, the original ones, which are not so much posts as chunks of wood fallen from the tree and covered with lichen, are rotting. He tells himself to remember to replace them in the spring. Only he will not be here in the spring. And remember how Rachel would say, "Tell you what I'm gonna do, see?" and punch you in the arm? Oh yes, Rachel. He rubs his arm over the duct tape patch on his down jacket where his daughter used to punch him. He has two daughters and one is dead. He remembers her as a child sitting on his lap, twirling her dark fine hair in her finger, and he remembers that she loved to be carried to bed on his back. "I wonder how my cabin is," he says. "You just asked me that, Dad. It's the same. It's always the same." He wonders if that's true, that he just asked that, or that it's always the same. He misses the cabin, and he knows nothing about it was ever the same, including the view from the window where the light would change as it shifted across the snowy seas of hayfields, where the small irrigation ditches would sparkle like rows of starlight, where the fox would pause and stare at him from the edge of a field, where the horses would dip their heads like swans. His cabin, his ranch. He fingers a thin slice of tree, the one in his pocket of his jeans. He sees in his mind's eye what he knows the paper says, and he's glad his mind's eye can be consistent with what is written on the paper, that the two sets flow together. Today he's tuned in, and he'll stay tuned in as long as he can. When he pulls the slice of tree out, it will be creased and worn to the point he can barely see his penciled marks, but he knows it will list his family. "I am married to Rennie. Carolyn is daughter, who is married to Dell. Rachel is dead daughter. 4 grandchildren. Jack, Leanne, Billy, Jess." He fingers the paper because it is calming and it stalls the terror. He can sense his own fear of this disease, how it has grown to be a constant companion now, but one on which he still has the upper hand. Today, he is winning. "I built it," he says. "I know, Dad, you did a good job. It's a beautiful cabin." "When Rachel died." "I know it. It's a nice, tight cabin. Dad, it never healed." She jams her hands into a red coat, takes them out, swings her arms. The fabric makes a swishing sound of water. Then, "What never healed, Dad? You mean you? You and Mom?" "The water is running backwards." She looks at him, even as they walk, and says, "If you say so. But Jess will take care of it." She swishes her arms back and forth. "Okay." Her voice is small and quiet like a mourning dove, like the soft gray on a mourning dove's back.
I've seen articles online that you've written where you talk about the character of Ben being based on your own father. What's the story behind that?
About 12 or 13 years ago, I was standing with my father in Denver, and we were helping one of my brothers move. And he just wouldn't get in the elevator. We'd been using the elevator all day, but all of a sudden he wouldn't get in. He didn't know what it was for, and he was scared of it. And, we were hot and tired and annoyed and trying to finish the moving. And at first I thought, what's going on with him? He's a smart man. He's a geneticist and a professor, and he raised 9 kids, and he knows what an elevator is. And then I had this sudden, horrible, sinking, bright flash of a realization, and I realized that something was really wrong with his mind. And it gave me a sick feeling to my stomach, and I just remember that moment perfectly. And soon after, he was diagnosed with dementia, probably Alzheimer's. I live close to the family ranch where I grew up and where he still lives with my mother, his primary caretaker. And I spend most of my time walking with him, and we walk back and forth across the ranch. At first, he could talk about the disease and the diagnosis, and then he couldn't. But he knew something was wrong. He would just say to me, "The body's doing great, but the mind's not doing so good." And now he's lost language mostly altogether. He can point to things and you know, notice a bald eagle, for instance. And I say, "Oh, yeah, that's a bald eagle." But mostly we just whistle. And he loves to whistle. He always has ever since I was a girl. So that's a joy we still share.
And what kind of a process did you go through trying to take your experiences with your father and put them into a character? And this character was in a previous novel.
He was. Ben and Rennie were the matriarch and patriarch of a whole sprawling family. And they are in my first book, which is called Hell's Bottom, Colorado. And I knew I wanted to revive them and write about them again. Meanwhile, I was walking with my dad a lot. And I've always understood my life by writing about it. I'm always saying that stories help us perceive and possess our lives. They help us see our life and then live it better. And so it's not surprising to me that I wrote a lot about my dad and the experience of his Alzheimer's. But then something kind of clicked in my brain. It was a very sudden switch. And I wanted to write about the world from his point of view, not mine. Not the caretaker, not the daughter walking, but how did he see the world? And I think the reason I became so enraptured with that idea was that he was becoming more and more of a poet. He was inventing words for things he could see, but couldn't find the word for. And I was struck on many occasions of like, wow, he's creating his own language and it's so poetic. It's a mishmash of words that don't always make sense, but the way he strings them together is gorgeous. And so I started writing about Ben. I decided Ben would be diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and I used the raw material of my life, but then, much of the book is fiction.
Aside from the beautiful language that you've used to tell the story, I was struck by the fact that I don't remember reading anything ever that tried to tell the story through the mind of someone who has dementia. So that was something new and I think important for people to be able to read that kind of a story and understand a little bit what might be happening in someone's brain.
That's my hope. I think it was very scary to be my father, and the fact that he couldn't find words and knew that he was going to find fewer words, that was very scary. And yet he was so brave and courageous about accepting it. I hadn't read that many books either. Frankly, there just aren't that many that I know of, told from the point of view of someone with Alzheimer's. So it was going to be both the challenge and the gift of the book, I knew, when I started it. And it would be the thing I was probably most proud of if I pulled it off.
I think you did. You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Laura Pritchett about her novel, Stars Go Blue. You can listen to this program again from our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link at our Facebook page. We'll be back shortly to talk about real-life family dynamics surrounding end-of-life choices and hear Rennie's point of view. Don't go away. Hear a little bit about Ben's wife, Rennie, just by having you read the first couple of pages of the second chapter.
You bet.
She's having a tough time.
She sure is, but I love her, and she's very different from Ben. All right, this is Rennie. At the early stage Alzheimer Association support group meeting in town, Rennie is separated from Ben, which makes her sigh with irritation. Only because everything makes her sigh with irritation, because she is in fact irritated. This is new, this parting of the waters. Ben goes off with the others to make Valentine cards for their caregivers, which is possibly the stupidest thing Rennie can think of. Or not stupid, just plain pitiful. Embarrassing. This separation will give caregivers a chance to speak freely, says Esme, the leader, whom Rennie really does like. If only her daughter Carolyn would dress so smartly instead of wearing jeans and t-shirt and ball cap with a ponytail pulled through the back. And Esme attends church, unlike her daughter. And Esme's name, which is short for Esmeralda, is very pretty. She should have named her daughter Esmeralda. Rennie sighs and glances around at the other women and men, all white-haired, some fat and some thin, some smart and some seemingly on the verge of the disease themselves. In the front of each person at the table is a journal, presented each week so they can vent their frustrations and feelings on paper. She was supposed to decorate hers, but instead she just wrote, "The Sad Story of Rennie and Ben," in thick Sharpie marker on the front. Everyone else cut out pictures of flowers or old automobiles from old-timey newspapers and glued them on the front, but she refuses to be reduced to childlike behavior. Beyond the journals in the middle of the table is a plate of cookies. She is so tired of these cheap brand cookies. No one likes them, and always Lipton tea, which no one likes either. She would like to issue a proclamation to the world. No one in the universe likes Lipton tea. Maybe people could stomach Lipton tea if fresh mint leaves and honey were also provided, but they never are. She wishes she and humanity could both get it right for once. When this winter is over and summer comes and the mint springs up next to the farmhouse, like weeds, even then she will forget to pick the mint. Every week, and these idiots will still be putting it out plain, even though no one wants it. She's sure of it, and she will drive Ben to this meeting and forget the mint because her life has always seemed too chaotic and busy to remember basic things like reaching down to grab the mint that is right at your feet. She sighs and then sighs again. She's so tired of the plates with creased edges, like a pie, only not a pie, only a boring white paper plate. She is tired of this winter. The truth. The truth is what Esme wants. When it is her turn, Rennie says one version of it, which is, if I care for him well, if I stay patient, well, then whatever freak God is out there might let me into heaven. I'm only nice because I believe he's watching. I'm afraid of hell. Otherwise, I would have flown off to Greece some time ago. A few others chuckle, but she isn't joking. God is a freak, must be, to allow people to suffer like this, and therefore must make freak decisions such as putting people in hell for letting their husbands die of a natural disease. Ben could have died a million times by now, burning down the house or crashing his truck. Perhaps he would have rotted like a fence post, forgetting to eat. Although no, he's always hungry and always wanting food, and it's his incessant whining about being hungry that makes her crazy. She wishes she could stay more patient, but it's like dealing with a 2-year-old, and she didn't even enjoy her daughters at that age. She liked kids when they were older and more self-sufficient and interesting. At some point, people have to die. Ben should just die. But the truth of the matter is that Ben is a good man who still loves his life. She looks around the room quickly to mitigate the closing sensation she is having in her throat. She's clarified this emotion with herself many times before. The simultaneous wish for him to die and never die makes her, at times, unable to breathe. The situation is, by its very nature, claustrophobic.
This novel raises the much-debated question of who gets to decide when someone's life ends. And Ben has spent his life as a cattle rancher, working with a veterinarian who would come and put down a sick animal, a dog, a horse, a cow. And the veterinarian comes to visit, and shortly thereafter, Rennie finds something that you call pink juice in the cupboard. So tell us about that.
Well, pink juice is what vets and ranchers use to put down animals when they're suffering, large animals, or when they need to be put down. Ben steals it from the vet, Reuben. I think this novel only would have worked if we had a rancher or someone like that, because Ben has been around so much birth and death, as all ranchers are, and that leads him to different conclusions about end-of-life care. And certainly, we are having and should continue to have a debate in this country of end-of-life decisions, particularly with dementia, when you lose your sense of free will or decision-making. That's the plot of the book, is that he needs to act quickly. There's something he wants to do, but he knows he has to move fast.
What happened when you tried to have end-of-life choices conversations with your own family?
This experience with my father has really changed my view of end-of-life care and made me much more confident in the path that I think I'll take if I find myself in this situation. Although, of course, that's a very easy thing to say from my vantage point. It has, however, pushed me into the realm of reading what's going on, everything from the Hemlock Society to Alzheimer's Association to what many people refer to as contented dementia. I mean, what do you want for people? And then how do you achieve it without making caregivers give up their life? Because really, Alzheimer's and dementia and similar conditions, they're taking away a lot of lives at once, or they're detracting from them, and it's adding to them. But I mean, let's be honest, it's some of it's very difficult, and caregiving is tough work. And so it's a topic I've become increasingly interested in.
And did other people in your family think that it was something they wanted to talk about?
No, I've met with a lot of resistance, frankly. One particular example is my father has a pacemaker, and it was put in about the year he was diagnosed. And so the question comes up, what about that battery when it needs to be recharged? It's my belief that he should be allowed to pass. I think that's what he would have wanted if he could articulate it. I think that that's what probably should happen for his own quality of life. But it's a hard decision. I'm not boiling it down to one simple answer, but it certainly caused a lot of problems in our family, to the point that I would say that there's been a kind of a mass dissolution of the bonds that we did have. And they might come back, but it's been a difficult path.
But he didn't want to, and nobody else wanted to talk about it when he was still able to? Is that what happened?
I tried to bring it up a lot with him, and by the time I was able to ask him those clear questions, he just kept saying, it'll get better, I'll get better. And so we had lost that opportunity. Previous to that, though, I remember being with him fishing on the Yampa River in Colorado, and we had a nice conversation about his father, who had died quickly in his sleep, and how glad he was for that, and that he never wanted to become a burden. And you know, all the things that seem very ironic or sad now that we had that conversation. And he was frankly glad that his parents had passed kind of quickly and without pain. It's hard to articulate. It would be hard to prove in a court of law. But he wouldn't have wanted this, and he doesn't want this now.
Mm-hmm. But that's the problem. He didn't make that clear in time.
He didn't. And I think it's contingent upon all of us. It's actually our ethical duty to speak to people about this. Early on, I'm in my 40s, and I've done my ethical will, I call it, not only my will, but my ethical will, which is what I would like my end of life to look like. I may not get it, and it may be out of my control, but I want to make it very clear to my kids and those around me that, given certain circumstances, that I want my life to end.
Mm-hmm. There's such a huge argument here because, for example, this book would not exist probably if you hadn't had that experience with your father. It's just so complicated. And then you have people's religious beliefs and personal beliefs and their fears, everything all wrapped into this one issue.
Sure. Many of us fear death. And that's what it comes down to. All the little fears and problems we have in life come down to a fear of death. And that's too bad. It's part of living. We need to die. So that said, I think the book was also a love letter to him and a love letter to his life with this condition. So it's not simply an argument for assisted suicide or death or some of the questions that Ben has to ask himself. It's also a celebration of who he was.
I'd like you to read one more passage. It's mm-hmm. just a very short one that shows a little bit about what he's thinking.
This is in the middle of the book, and it's from Ben's point of view. Ben stands in his darkened bedroom and cannot remember why he's there. He is next to his bed, looking down at his suitcase. It's like a cave, this room, dark with stalagmites of cracks in the plaster, with old, thick, original windows that are buckled and warped because the glass has turned to water. On the shelf, there is a photo of his mother and father and sister, all dead. He used to work cattle with them at the old place in Greeley, and he remembers how well they'd run the cows in the corral before sending them through the chute. He remembers the onion crop and the sugar beets. He remembers that the town was founded on the idea of irrigation, that a man, long ago, Horace Greeley his name was, had thought to build a utopian community on the plains. How another man, James Michener his name was, wrote a book called Centennial, and if he remembers correctly, that author got it about right. about the hardships and the dust and the hopes and the calloused hands of working the desert into fruition. But in certain ways, he wonders if moving all that water was ruining the earth even as it watered it into being. The balance got upset. There's a funny thing he's realizing, which is that his mind is just like the cows in the V of a fence. He has cornered his diseased mind and he can separate it and give it vaccinations. He can observe it and keep records of it, as he would a cow. But someday it will come out of the corner and meet up with the rest of his mind, and he won't be able to corner it any longer. Like a heifer gone berserk, no keeping her in. He told Rennie he was taking a nap, but the truth is the time has come. Greeley, Colorado. He writes it on a notepad because now he remembers why he's standing by his bed. He knows that things with many steps get hard. Lists are good. For example, the story of the woman in his disease group who used to make biscuits. She loved biscuits, but there were too many steps. Now she has to use Bisquick, even though she does not like Bisquick. She holds his hands at the meetings, and he always wonders if she feels angry at the boxed biscuits. He has made a good list, and that's important because there are lots of things to think through. The list is in his suitcase. He consults it now and doesn't move on to the next item until he is sure. He has packed his clothing, his Colt 45, bullets, the pink juice, syringes, money, which he has stolen from Rennie because she thinks he doesn't know fives from 50s and doesn't let him carry cash anymore. He has written a note with his name in case it gets bad. My name is Ben Cross. I am trying to get to Greeley, Colorado. He also has the newspaper clipping that he carried around since it was printed, the one detailing the sentencing of Ray and the death of Rachel. It's dusty in here, in this bedroom, in this Sears mail-order house that was built 100 years ago and which he bought when he was 30 and thus has lived here for 40 or 60 or a long time years. He picks up a picture of his father and sees how dusty it is, and so he wipes the frame on the front of his shirt. It cleans the glass but leaves a smudge of dirt on the gray wool. That's what his brain reminds him of, dust. That's how he sees the world. There are sometimes small specks of dust and sometimes whole rooms of dust, and sometimes it blows away and he can see very well, and other times it is so dusty that he doesn't even know what lies on the other side of the dust.
Some reviewers have called Stars Go Blue a dark story, but I didn't see it that way. I thought the novel ended with a huge ray of hope because I imagine that it's going to open up conversations about this really challenging subject.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that because I think it's a tough book, but not a dark book. It takes on some tough topics, but hello, life, that's life. Sometimes people say to me, oh, we don't like your books, they're a little too tough. And I say, well, it's the main course. You can have dessert later. I mean, there are dessert books and they're wonderful, but that's not what I write.
No, you write stuff that makes people think. Hallelujah.
Thank you.
Laura Pritchett lives in Colorado near the small cattle ranch where she was raised. There's more about her and her books at mtpr.org/twq and on our Facebook page. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.